So now we're going to talk a little bit about how we came to this project, and we're going to read from our intro, which talk about that, and just talk a little bit about also what it was like to work on this project for 7 years. We never lived in the same city, so it was a lot of emails and conference calls and kind of like crazy meetups in the middle of
nervous breakdowns.
Yeah, fields and hot tubs and stuff. When I was 17 years old, I began a relationship with a coworker at the movie theater where I worked, and my family freaked out. He was a Brazilian immigrant without what they considered a good job or good educational background. For the first time in my life, I lied to my family and snuck out of the house in the middle of the night to meet him. Eventually, my mother told me to sign a contract that I would break off my relationship with him or not be allowed out of the house to go to college, and I signed. I emerged from that experience resolved not to let anyone else control or decide for me whom I was involved with or what kind of relationships I chose to have. But I also became very protective and stubborn about my intimate relationships. It became hard for me to open up and let others know what was going on in those spaces of my life. 4 years later, after moving to a city where I knew no one, and while in another relationship I knew my family wouldn't approve of, I turned my back on my family and friends. We were stressed out about immigration status and making the rent. In the late afternoons and evenings, I canvassed for a rape crisis center with a group of women who were largely rape and sexual assault survivors, and my partner was driving a cab on the night shift. When our relationship became volatile, I had no one to turn to and no support system. At the time, I didn't feel part of any community. Part of my relationship experience was the feeling of being isolated. No friends, no place to go to outside of our apartment, no organization where I felt I belonged or that knew me and my history. Years later, when I started building a circle of activists who shared similar commitments to social justice, community had come to mean not having to feel alone and isolated, being hopeful that there were ways to figure out how to feel safe in whichever ways we needed to be. And then being able to count on someone outside of myself, which was very hard for me to do. When a friend whom I had met through community work needed to escape from an abusive husband, we worked out a system that she would call me when she was ready and I would drive over and get her out of there. And it worked. But I soon learned that not everything was that easy or simple or clear cut. A good friend confided in me about her abusive relationship, but wanted me to act to the outside world like nothing was going on. And we were all part of the same organizing collective. I entered into relationships where I didn't know what to do because we were doing this kind of work together. Sometimes my friends hadn't yet figured out what could be helpful or didn't want to talk about it. Sometimes I felt too far away to be of much use or help or didn't realize the impact of what I was doing until much later. This anthology is something that I would have loved, read, found useful through my journeys, both in the situations I found myself in and in supporting my loved ones. I hope you find it useful as well.
Yeah. In 1996, I'm 21 years old. I'm having sex with my lover in a field outside a hippie music festival where we've both gotten in for free by staffing the anti-racist action table. We are the two queer people of color at the entire festival. I'm falling in love with my mixed race, queer of color, survivor, separated at birth brother, totally sure that this is the amazing, transformative relationship I've been waiting for my whole life. It absolutely was. And it also became a relationship full of long fights that went nowhere, screening matches in the street, and chokeholds that I couldn't talk about during the meeting of the prison justice newspaper we both attended the next day. When this violence happened in our relationship, I didn't even think about going to the police as an option that would keep me safe. My partner was a young queer man of color who'd already done time for, quote, resisting arrest, unquote, after being beaten by the police. He was stopped every day by a cop who wanted to make extra sure he had lights and a bell on his bike, who wanted to know where he was going, who wanted to know if he was selling weed. Organizers involved in many different kinds of people of color, anti-police brutality, and anti-prison coalitions. Our phones stayed turned on even when we didn't pay the bill for months. Once CISA showed up at our door. When neighbors in our broke-ass apartment building, tired of us screaming at each other, called the cops, the first thing the police did when they arrived was to ask me about my immigration status and my partner's probation, not what I needed to feel safe. I had no faith that any prison would lift the weight of oppression, trauma, and rage off of my lover. The problem was, we really didn't know what to do instead. I believed with my whole 22-year-old heart in the power of human beings to change, in the power of self-transformation. My entire politic was based around it. My lover believed in it too, but after he body slammed me into the sidewalk and I ran onto the bus without a token, I told him that we'd never be lovers again, but we still stayed essentially partnered for a couple of years. He dropped out of the batter intervention program saying that those men were nothing like him or who he wanted to be. He went to two elders in our community for guidance, but 2 years later, with no change in the frightening parts of his behavior, I left. A year later, I took a job at a second wave feminist of color-led anti-violence crisis line in Toronto. The workers there believed that it was a mistake to think or even ever suggest that abusers could ever change. They just promised they would to keep their partners trapped in the cycle of violence. We knew that cops were terrible, that restraining orders didn't work, that First Nations people, immigrant people of color, and cis and trans people of color who were us and who called our line every day were more likely to be harmed than served by the criminal legal system. But what else could we do? This book is an attempt to answer that question.
So this is, we're going to read a little bit from our introduction, which is written by both of us, but also Jay Dumont. This book began with our individual stories, stories of surviving relationships that are beautiful and dangerous, of trying to move towards safety, justice, and healing without using the cops or the courts, of bushwhacking our way through alleyways, back roads, starlit fields without maps. And it is our individual stories that remain at this book's core. But our stories are so much bigger than our individual experiences. Gathered together, they are the stories of everyone searching for and finding fresh-cut ways of keeping ourselves, our fam, and our communities safe. I'm going to skip a little bit and just talk a little bit about kind of some of the concepts that we've been mentioning. What we call community accountability, some call it transformative justice, others call it as many names as there are people, has existed for as long as we hold collective memory. A simple definition of community accountability: any strategy to address violence, abuse, or harm that creates safety, justice, reparations, and healing without relying on police, prisons, childhood protective services, or any other state systems. Instead of police and prisons, community accountability strategies depend on something both potentially more accessible and more complicated: the community surrounding the person who was harmed and the person who caused harm. Many people are also working with the term transformative justice. The organization Generation 5 defines transformative justice as an approach to respond to and prevent child sexual abuse and other forms of violence that puts transformation and liberation at the heart of the change. It is an approach that looks at the experiences of both the individuals and communities involved and the larger social conditions at work. An approach that seeks to integrate both personal and social transformation. Restorative justice is a term that many people might find more familiar. In restorative justice frameworks, those who have been harmed take an active role in addressing that harm and or violence, whether it be gender violence, petty theft, or assault. And those who have caused harm are expected to take responsibility for their actions, to repair the harm they've done, for example, by apologizing, returning stolen money, or doing community service. The focus is on restoring as much as possible the situation to the conditions as they were before the harm. However, critics of restorative justice argue that there are serious limits to restoring the situation to what it was before the harm. What if the situation was shitty in the first place?
And this is our collaborative reading. And as Native feminist and Insight Women of Color Against Violence co-founder Andrea Smith has pointed out, restorative justice has often failed women, especially women of color and indigenous women facing intimate or stranger violence. And she contributed this quote, which I think is really deep, where she said, for the community to hold someone accountable, they have to actually think that what happened was wrong in the first place. So you can't rely on a romanticized notion of community or even assume that community actually exists. For a community-based response to be effective requires a political organizing component to it that actually creates communities that offer accountability. So that last sentence, every time I read it, people are kind of like, huh, okay, and they need to sit with it for a minute. But what I get from this is just that a lot of the times the communities that I've been part of, you know, we're like, we don't like prisons, we don't like the police, we don't like all these systems that are causing us harm. And often people are like, okay, the community's gonna take care of it. And actually, the community is so complicated and the community may not really be all on the same page about what violence looks like or how we respond or whether a perpetrator is always a perpetrator or what we're doing with all of the stuff we're rolling around with. So it's kind of like a make the road by moving forward on it approach where we have to actually build and strengthen our communities if they're going to be there to create the safety we need. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Everyone's nodding? Okay, beautiful. Is it you next? Is it me next? Okay. Hold this for me. Okay. So, like Jimmy said, we started working on this project in 2003, so this has been 7 years of building to create this book. And I just want to talk a little bit, I was going to read, but I think I'm just going to sum up some stuff. I just want to talk a little bit about the process of making this book, because it's intense and it's also really inspirational. So in 2003, myself, Chingy, and Delani actually all knew each other through being queer Asian Pacific Islander poets. And Shami Ali, who was someone who was involved in the zine project and who also dropped out, who did not continue working on the book. We had in mind a little zine. I remember the day that I was on whatever was around before GChat with you guys at my day job, and I was really upset because my ex-partner had been invited to DJ at like a violence against women night, or like an anti-violence against women night, but he was kind of making it a violence against women night. Anyway, it got complicated, and I was feeling really frustrated. We were all chatting online, and I was like, you know, I just feel really stuck. Like, there's not really, I just wish there was a resource out there that collected more of these stories and talked about what we can do instead. And so the idea for the zine was born, and honestly, I can't speak for the co-editors, but I think at the beginning we really thought it was going to be a little 8.5 by 11 self-produced zine, and that it would come out in a year, and that would be it. And some things that ended up happening were that, first of all, it didn't take a year. It was a much more complicated process than we thought it would be to get people's stories. I was fairly out about my situation in my community, so I knew a lot of people personally would come to me and talk about similar situations. And I really naively was like, oh yeah, I'll just write all of them and they'll write the story of their experience and it'll be great. And shockingly, this is not actually what happened. So that was going on, like building, working with people to create the safety they needed and to plan around what sharing those stories was going to be like for them was a really intense process. The other thing that happened was that we kind of, as we talked about it, we were like, okay, we want to collect stories. Definitely there's a lot to be said for just documenting stories of intimate violence within activist communities so that we don't all feel like freaks when we're reading the mainstream anti-violence against women accounts and nobody really necessarily looks like us. But in 2004, Insight Women of Color Against Violence, and I want to say that like they are not the first people to do community accountability strategies. People have been doing them forever, but just to name the moment that we were in, they had just released a couple of documents looking at all these different strategies that people were coming up with to intervene in violence about the cops. And mostly there's one document they did called the Community Accountability Working Group Principles, where you can tell it's a bunch of people who were in a conference room with butcher paper, really tired, who were like, let's just brainstorm. And they brainstormed like 120 different ways that women of color and gender non-conforming people of color could intervene in violence without the police. And the other thing that we did was we looked at those ideas and we were like, these all look really amazing, and we're really wondering what they look like in practice, because they all look so great on paper, and we were like, what are the stories of people actually doing this stuff in real life? So just to say that, like, that at the same time as we're collecting individual stories, we also wanted to really have roadmaps and have people talking about, this is what we did and this worked, or it didn't actually work all the way, it got really screwed up and complicated, or it worked but it took three times as long as we thought it would. So fast forward to 2008, where the zine was 108 pages long, and I kept almost getting busted stealing copies at Office Max because it was very expensive to pay for the zine to be photocopied. And we moved to creating this book together, which has taken it to a whole other level of process. But, and it's really exciting that the book is out. We just got asked in this interview, what's the, you know, one of those questions that's kind of silly, that's like, what's the most exciting part about this book coming out for you guys? And I was really tired, but I was just like, just the fact that it's an actual book that's in libraries, and that's really amazing and solid. At the same time, I just want to put it out there that I think it's important to remember that this started as an idea some folks had during their day jobs that was going to be something that was completely do-it-yourself, completely self-published, and that's where I think a lot of the strength of the book came from.
I just wanted to add that you can still find the original zine on the Insight website. It's really different, and one of the really exciting things was, I think when we first started, it was a lot more kind of personal first-person accounts, which I think are really important. And we were kind of chasing down different organizations that we thought were doing this work that could contribute. And that was really, really challenging. And we had some in the zine, but there are a lot more in this anthology, which we're really excited about. And just the amount of organizations and collectives and people that are grappling with this work now, as opposed to when we first started working on it, that's really exciting to see. And so I think we feel like this is the beginning of a conversation, and we're just excited to see a lot of what will happen with everybody that's talking about this and working on this, and see what will happen in the future. So what we're going to do is we're going to read some selections from different contributors, and it's going to be a mix of first person, more personal stories, and more collective strategies. So, okay.
Yes. Okay. 160.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to read this piece by N, and it's called A Sliding Stance. I stand in the stone corridor, looking at the uniformed court officer with wide eyes. I am here checking out the space before my court date to get a peace bond against my lover. What do you mean we all wait in the same space? I ask. Don't worry, just ignore him, dear. Ignore him, right. Later, the judge will call my lover Mr. Give her masculine pronouns despite her obviously female name. I will learn a lot through this process about the gendered assumptions surrounding relationship violence. We didn't fit their framework of understanding. The truth was, though, in their own way, my queer feminist activist communities didn't know any more what to do with me or us than the courts did. I sometimes felt profoundly alone, like I was drowning in the collective silence and judgments built around me. And in very different ways, I wouldn't doubt this also to be my lover's experience. In either case, nothing on offer seemed very helpful. I didn't love the option of engaging the court system, it being an institution embedded in racism, classism, patriarchy. At demos, cops were always on the other side, a force we were generally fighting against. It wasn't a decision I made easily or lightly. Unfortunately, there didn't appear to be a lot of other options available. I didn't trust my lover to hold herself accountable, and who else would be there to deal with whatever came next? However conflicted my decision, in the absence of community alternatives, it offered me some promise of response, some authority where I felt like I had none. My refusal to see her didn't stop her from showing up at my house. My shouts didn't stop her fist. It is the morning of filing my statement with the police, who would now hand deliver the court summons to my ex-partner. My new lover thinks this is an occasion to celebrate. You must be relieved. No, my choice paradoxically involves giving over control, an uneasy space I occupy after a relationship where I felt so little of it. I feel an overwhelming grief I have been staving off by procrastinating until the deadline. That our relationship is over is undeniably real to me in this moment. How could I say that even after everything, part of me still longed for her? It is a difficult thing to explain to anyone who hasn't been there. From the outside, this possibility seems unimaginable. From the outside, things seem clear and straightforward. From the inside, life is held in powerful contradictions. I lived our profound intimacy that, when good, was quite magical. The person with whom at times I felt the most safe, the most alive, was the same person at times I both dreaded and feared. The person who could be big and angry could just as easily be intensely vulnerable and incredibly loving. For all her suffering, I thought I could love her pain away, that I just had to love her bigger, better. Once out of the relationship, I worked hard to see the hooks, how deep our socialization runs, part Catholic upbringing to honor commitment no matter what, part fairy tale belief that true love only comes once, that somewhere inside of me, I clung to my values, and my fear clung to me. To my homophobic family, how much I wanted to show you that queer relationships could be healthy and long-lasting, that I could have what you have, that I could be just like you, and how, because of this, I have kept my silence, and you don't know me as well as you might. It would be easier to tell you that the story ends there, that I picked up the pieces and moved on, but it doesn't. After I got a peace bond against her, I violated the bond myself, sometime later, by seeing her and getting back together with her. Some were brave enough to say I was betting on the wrong horse, but I wasn't ready to hear that. My health held a meeting with us during which my partner listened to and addressed their concerns about how her behavior had eroded their sense of safety too. She would have to earn back their trust. And I believe she would, because things were different for a while. But this new narrative, though useful, left no room inside the relationship to name old behaviors, old ways, if they didn't exist anymore. Soon enough, the narrative began unraveling, but in the face of people's judgment and my own hope for change, how could I admit this to anyone, even myself? Rarely did I get time alone to even think such thoughts. She accused me of using my femme and passing privileges against her through the court process, using my class privilege when I didn't pay for this or that, of not knowing what it was to be a real survivor. When she disclosed affairs, my hurt and anger was evidence of my lack of internal security and radical politics. Everyone has a bottom line. Sometimes you just don't know what it is until you hit it. Mine came in a moment that, in the bigger picture, was a more ordinary betrayal. Another poly agreement broken, knowingly, and right in front of me. Humiliation aside, I experienced a moment of pure clarity when I realized this will not stop. This will not stop, no matter what I do or how much I love her. I decided I was finally done.
Beth, that Chinyi just read was a really personal narrative, and we wanted to mix it up a little bit, like Chinyi was saying. So the next section I'm going to read is from an interview with Alexis Pauline Gums. Does anyone here know Alexis's work? Okay, for people who don't, like, just Google her name. Like, she's a really amazing queer black feminist who lives in Durham, North Carolina. And her piece is called I Am Because We Are, Believing Survivors and Facing Down the Barrel of the Gun. And it's mostly about her work with the group that she co-founded called Ubuntu, which translates to the concept I Am Because We Are, which is a really incredible black feminist-led survivor group in Durham. And Durham, center of the universe. And I just want to say, do people remember the Duke University rape case a couple years ago? So for people who don't know, like Ubuntu came together, the way I first found out about them was that they came together in protest of that case, and they started a thing they called the National Day of Truth Telling, where basically they have a march that fills the street with women of color holding signs that say, I believe survivors and someone I love is a sex worker, which is really amazing. And they also do, I don't know, I could gush a lot, they're really great. So a question that was asked in this interview was, Alexis, you mentioned that at Ubuntu you, quote, have created a complicated community of people who are ready to be there for each other in times of need, including recent instances of partner abuse, loss of loved ones, etc., and to celebrate each other. Quote, we just had an amazing fair trade chocolate extravaganza to celebrate a 35th birthday in our community, unquote. Can you talk more about the concrete ways people in this community have found to be there for each other and intervene in situations involving partner violence? What does that look like? And her answer is, I'm really proud of the fact that we've built a community that allows us to call on each other. I've told people that I really wish my mother had access to a community of support like this when I was growing up. I wish she had access to a community like this right now. When violence is something that has to be managed all alone by the person experiencing it, the cost is huge, especially when there's little ones involved. So far, our immediate responses to partner violence have included literally being there for an Ubuntu community member who had reason to fear physical violence from her partner and brainstorming together to make a plan that provided safety for her and her family on her own terms. Creating that safety plan included offering our homes as safer places for her and her children to stay, staying at her house, providing childcare, researching legal options and community-based alternatives to those legal options, coming up with plans, backup plans, and times and places to check in and shift the plan, and listening and listening and listening and being ready to support. In one instance, an Ubuntu member happened to meet a young woman of color who was walking down her street after being beaten by a former partner. She called the rest of us to see who was home and available in the immediate neighborhood, took the young woman into her home, and contacted the spiritual leader of the woman who'd experienced the violence. We also made calls to other women from the spiritual community that the young woman trusted, who came to her house and made sure she received medical care. She also arranged for members of our Ubuntu family to have a tea session with the young woman to talk about healing and options, to share our experiences, and to embrace the young woman and let her know that she was not alone in her healing process. In each of these cases, all of these responses were invented on the spot. We didn't have a pre-existing model or a logistical agreement, but they were made possible by a larger understanding that we, as a collective of people living all over the city, are committed to responding to gendered violence. This comes out of the political education and collective healing work we've done and the building of relationships with each other that strongly send the message, you can call me if you need something or if you don't. You can call me to be there for you or someone that you need help being there for. Since we've come to see each other as real resources, we no longer think our only option is to call the state when faced with violence. In that way, everything we do to create community, from childcare, community gardening, community dinners, film screenings in our living rooms, political discussions, and much more, helps to clarify how, why, and how deeply we are ready to be there for each other in both times of violence and times of celebration.
Before I read this next piece, I want to say that there were a lot of pieces that I really wanted to read from, but it was really difficult because of the way they were written in terms of complexity of strategies. One piece I want to highlight in particular is Mara Hari's piece, which focuses a lot on immigrant organizing, and it's very long, so it didn't feel like it would be easy to share with you, but I just want to highlight it for you. And I'm going to read a piece, just one part of a piece by Anna Marie Lara, and it's called There's Another Way. And it's also a very long piece, and I'm just going to read a section of it. And I just wanted to say that
that there might be a little triggering. So just to give a warning about that.
People can always remember all the amazing survival strategies that are in our bodies that have brought us to this point that we already have to rely on.
So this is part three, and it's an example from my own life. Many years ago, when I was 23, I dated a woman, Kay, who was incredibly abusive. She tried to destroy my friendships, and she demonstrated small but increasing forms of physical violence that culminated in a gun threat. We worked together, and though we were in different buildings after the destructive breakup, which I initiated because I couldn't take her controlling behavior, she followed me around during work hours for about 3 months. I quit my job as soon as possible and made sure that I changed my social life to avoid the places where she hung out. This sucked for me, but I didn't want to risk seeing her. It didn't matter. Kay always figured out ways to find me. The moment of personal fury and epiphany came almost 2 years later when she approached an acquaintance, let's call her Sarah, and informed her of my so-called betrayal of her love. Sarah, someone with whom I was doing intense community work, was not familiar with the violence I had lived through with this woman. I had never felt the need to talk about Kay. I just wanted to forget about her. Sarah came over to my home one day, telling me that they had spoken, and that I had a responsibility to ensure that all of our community was taken care of. I was so upset at the entire scenario, at Kay for trying to reach me through a friend, at Sarah for her one-sided request for my accountability, and at myself for having kept silent for so long. I turned pale. After taking an hour to calm down, to digest what had just happened, I explained to Sarah why I had broken off all communication with Kay. Sarah, also a survivor of abuse, indicated that she understood. She started crying, having realized how she was manipulated by Kay. However, a few months later, Sarah invited both me and Kay to a party without informing either of us that the other person would be there. When I asked Sarah, whom I considered a close friend, why she had done this, she said it was not her responsibility to value one community member over the other. I left the party. I felt betrayed by Sarah, and I felt that I had been placed in danger. I didn't understand until much later how Sarah's own history of abuse manifested itself in the form of manipulating social relationships. I didn't understand how her own blocks against confronting her own abuser meant that she constantly put her friends in situations where they were expected to be able to confront their abusers, even if they weren't ready to do so. From her perspective, she was healing our communities. From mine, she had created a context for potentially perpetuating violence. If prior to that moment, I had not done the work of taking care of myself, of ensuring my own safety and mental health, who knows what kinds of violence could have been perpetuated at that party? What if I had tried to confront my abuser and she had turned violent? What if my own anger materialized in the form of violence? The truth is, the community was small, especially that of queer organizers of color. We all knew each other. For me, after my relationship with Kay, it had been especially important that I take steps to ensure my personal safety and seek help from friends and counselors. It was especially important because I was working with other survivors and with people going through abuse in that moment, abuse that is an ongoing reality within my communities. If I had not been working on getting solid on my own stuff, who knows what kinds of energy I would have put out at that party in that moment with my community? Who knows what kind of energy I would have called forth while being triggered? That incident became an important catalyst for discussions about partner abuse, as all of my friends who had been at the party realized something was going on. First, because we cared about each other, people noticed I left the party. Second, when folks asked me days later, I decided to break the silence around what had happened with Kay. This, in turn, encouraged other women in our community to break the silence regarding their own experiences of abuse with Kay. When we realized it was a shared experience of violence, we created bridges to hold each other close, to safeguard ourselves and each other. We also created bridges to hold each other accountable and to generate spaces of healing that were consensual and transparent. After that night, I never saw Kay again. She recently found me on Facebook. I blocked her. In our community discussions, we asked ourselves to identify the roots of our pain, to define community and community work. We asked ourselves what it meant to be accountable, how to differentiate loyalty from truth, and how to hold truth gently. We started to analyze the frameworks we were using to define our work. It became clear that a trust had been broken between Sarah and me, and that in order for the work to continue to be effective, we would have to heal, and that trust would have to be restored. It became evident that typical movement models of mediation and community work were not what we were using, nor were they appropriate or adequate. What we were attempting required redefining accountability in terms of practicing total honesty about where we were at emotionally and spiritually, putting the ugliest parts of ourselves out in front of our peers, and trusting they would help us grow stronger, taking ownership of our mistakes, and recognizing being nice, loving, and kind as revolutionary values central to our work. The first part of that piece is survivors' rights and responsibilities, which is also a really amazing part, which I encourage you to check out. Okay. How's everyone doing? So what's up?
Okay, so is this the last thing we're going to do? Wow. Okay, so thank you guys for sitting with us, and we're also really excited to open it up to like questions and talking with you guys, because we know there's a lot of really fierce people who are doing this work in the room. The last section I'm going to read is from a piece called It Takes Ass to Whip Ass, which is a roundtable of sex workers talking about sex workers countering violence in our lives and relationships. And Juliet November, who's a Toronto sex worker organizer, interviewed three really, really fierce people, Jessica Yee, who I think some people in this room know, Miss Major, who's a Stonewall veteran and also someone who lived through the Attica Rebellion and who founded the Trans Justice in Prison Project in San Francisco, and Marico Passion. So Miss Major did speaking about basically how mostly Black and Latina trans women sex workers that she came up with fought back against street violence in the 60s and 70s, said, excuse me, so with violence you go through stages. You can fight back physically. Sometimes you can't do that, especially for girls who are working the streets. So then sometimes we'd carry two bricks in our purse, two red bricks, and reinforce the purse strap so it wouldn't snap off when you hit someone with it. If girls had cars, we'd get little kids' baseball bats about a foot long, soak them in water for 2 weeks. That way when you use it, it doesn't break. Then you dry it, cover it with electrical tape, just the exact width of your hand, one side of the tape down, one side up, so that once you grabbed it, it was in your hand till you were through. We keep those under the front seat. Necessity is the mother of invention. We would go to bars, take cue balls, and put them in two socks. Girl, it takes ass to whip ass. If you're going to take a piece of mine, I'm going to take a piece of yours. Some of the girls would match the socks to whatever they were wearing because, you know, you have to be flashy. We'd work in neighborhoods together. If we saw a girl running, all she'd have to do was scream, and we'd all wait for the boys to follow us. Then we'd all run behind them. We listened for this because we knew we weren't in a safe zone. When the girl knew we were behind her, she'd usually stop, and then it was on. We don't always win, but we've got to protect ourselves because we can't afford to be hit in the face or in the chest and have our bodies messed up. If you can't fight, you buy a gun sometimes. And that's intense, but that's real. And I think one of the things we wanted to do in presenting these pieces was to show the breadth of response that community response can look like. So we just met a piece you have a Black trans woman sex worker talking about fighting back in the 60s, where there's no legal protection and not a lot of community protection either, except what people could do for each other in a really intense situation. And then we have stories that we've shared about many, many different community responses, some good, some much more complicated and complex, that are stories that we walk around with all the time. And also just talking about with the Ubuntu piece and other pieces, like the really long-term work it takes to build communities where we actually have real relationships, where we can be there for each other and know how to intervene. I know every time I read that Ubuntu section, part of me feels like, wow, that's kind of so obvious, right? And then I think, wait a minute, if I was walking down the street and I saw a young woman that I didn't know who had just been assaulted, would I know how to automatically walk up to her and be like, hey, are you doing okay? And invite her into my house. I mean, there's so many things that are out there in the world that encourage us not to know how to move to even people we know and are intimate with, let alone people who are part of our communities, but who we don't necessarily know personally. So did you have other stuff you wanted to say?
The only other thing I want to add is that we've gotten this question before. We really wanted to also center queer and trans experiences. And that's why I think some of the stuff that was read was...
Queer?
Yeah. Any questions or, comments? Maybe that's very obvious, but we got that question when we read different things that maybe were not as...
Wait, when people were like, how come everybody in your book is gay? Are gay people more violent? Yeah, that was intense. We were like, no, we just, you know, there's a lot of stuff. There's straight people in the book, too. We just were centering marginalized experiences. Because, you know, oppression and stuff, right? And we're like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Yeah, so we're going to open up the questions. Thank you guys for being in the room. And, you know, you're awesome.
Vancouver.mediacoop.ca.